Ilya Ponomarenko is a Ukrainian journalist, war reporter, and defense analyst, formerly writing for the Kyiv Independent. In January 2023, given his prominent role in reporting from the conflict, he was described by Der Spiegel as likely the best-known Ukrainian after President Volodymyr Zelensky. He's written an account of his experiences reporting on the war. I will show you how it was, the story of wartime Kyiv, and that is to be released in August 2024. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. Please like, subscribe, and definitely comment on the videos to help people discover the fantastic guests who've given their time to get the message about Ukraine across. Please also check out the validated Ukrainian charities that appear in the description of the video. It's incredibly important to support Ukraine and Ukrainians in their resistance against Russian aggression at this time. Ilya, welcome to the channel.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, you've written this extraordinary book, and it goes without saying I strongly recommend everyone watching this channel to go out, buy it, read it, and really immerse themselves in it. I'm going to ask the obvious question here about your motivations and the experience of writing the book, because you know you've immersed yourself in the reporting from day one. I'm assuming a lot of the stuff you've seen is difficult, even traumatic. How does that relate to the process of writing the book? Did it bring back a lot of those initial impressions?
I decided to write a book, particularly about the Battle of Kyiv, closer to the end of 2022. Because I've been thinking about this for quite a long time, since the end of the Battle of Kyiv. And I decided to do this because the Battle of Kyiv and what happened in early 2022 was so surprising to me, such a milestone in my perception in modern history, such an unexpected, miraculous victory in many ways, a man-made miracle against so many odds, against such a dark expectations, as half of the world, as you remember, was just burning Ukraine alive. And that was an event of history that we witnessed from inside and in which we in many ways participated to. And it was such an incredible act of human bravery, enthusiasm, courage, good faith also, good hope, that it essentially turned history, changed the course of history against so many expectations of Russia lost. And these events, those days, left such a heavy imprint on me that I just couldn't find any better topic for me to talk about. But initially, I wanted this to be probably the first one or one of the first books in terms of, you know, military history of those days. You know, maps, arrows, fancy military terms, but later, I decided that there are people who are much more better at this than me. And I have really something else to tell, especially when it comes to Western audience. You know, the feelings, the personal experience behind these things, behind a very incredible event in modern European history, that we have a capital of a city that's being attacked, almost encircled in an attempt to destroy entire country. And this was supposed to be an apocalypse that never happened because of so many people, regular people just look like you and me, doing what they should do, believing in what is right and doing what is right. So that was, up to this day, it's such a moment of hope for me up to this day, that I decided that I need to do this, and I need to have a very sincere and personal conversation with the reader about this. Not those military maps and arrows and, you know, analysis, but something, you know, humane, something that is close to any human being, you know, emotions, you know, what's at stake, what it's like to be in the middle of that apocalypse that was decided upon us, because such things, they are the end of so many things that we in normal, peaceful life have. but often we don't appreciate them to the full extent. You know, the quiet happiness of having a lunch with your family, you know, getting back from work and going to bed, absolutely being 100% sure about the next day, that tomorrow will come, and there'll be a peaceful day, just usual. In general, you know, this happiness of having peace and a silent life and quiet life and, you know, joyful life. And when it comes to the gathering storm of war with Death Army gathering across your capital city and essentially spelling the end of this decade of reforms in Ukraine following the Euromaidan revolution, you know, the entire epoch for which my generation fought for to make this country a better place. That's definitely quite an emotion. And you know, from day one, sometimes without any purpose, just because of personal intuition, and I was not alone in this, but we in Ukraine, we in many ways relied on something more than just, you know, reporting headlines and talking about these things, but also to talk with our audience as human beings, to be as humane and as lively as possible, so that we can reach out to so many minds and hearts in the West and to, you know, gain more supporters and to explain more people what it is that's happening and why supporting Ukraine and helping Ukraine deal with this is so important. So I decided to do this. And, you know, in many ways, you know, among journalists, there's this like a golden rule that saying that you are not the story. You are not the story. So it's not about you, it's about the people that you see. And in many ways, my book is not definitely not about me, not about myself. It's just about regular people that I saw with my own eyes, incredible people, incredible things that we saw with my own eyes. And it's a sincere, very honest, imperfect conversation, emotional conversation, sometimes emotional conversation, a sincere conversation with friends in your audience from a guy who was among so many millions of Ukrainians trapped in this, who did what he could and what he should in those days, and who also happened to be a journalist in those days. So that's a tale from one guy, from one Ukrainian guy. I think from my experience, that was the best thing that I could tell about those days. I don't think that I would get very good military history book. Yeah.
And there are plenty of those. There are plenty of YouTube channels which, you know, analyze the day by day changes in the front line. I think what you've brought to this is unique and very important. And you've described it as an unscripted Ukrainian victory, almost unplanned in some ways. On the other hand, this victory couldn't have happened without, you say, the involvement of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Ukrainians really pulling in the same direction, fighting for the same thing. You know, whether they are on the left or the right of politics, however they define themselves in terms of their personal or political identity, there's a commonality of purpose that comes across. How important do you think that was, and how important that people had a common sense of defending the Maidan values and defending all the changes that had happened in the previous sort of revolutions and upheavals that Ukraine has experienced over 30 years?
This is actually the central topic and the central message of the book. Believe in what was right, believe in what is right, having good faith, and acting and doing what needs to be done with little to no hope, but with good faith about what's happening and our role in this, and going the hard way, as we call it. You know, this very basic and simple moral principle that sometimes people forget about in our days, in our lives. This is the central, actually, the central message behind this book is that, you know, hard choices and having good faith about complicated and hard things, they play out. This is the way we came to what we have right now here in Ukraine, to more than 2 years since those days and since the victory at Kyiv. So that was the central message. And moreover, what was generally shocking to me in a positive way is that it was about so many people from very regular, absolutely regular people, even beyond the military community, but also about top-tier politicians, including people like Vladimir Zelensky. In many ways, you know, what sometimes people say that war really shows a human being's true nature. You know, everybody reveals their true self in the war. And what I saw in many of my friends, my personal friends from my life, and what I saw from people like Zelensky, and I've always been critical of Zelensky about his character, personality, about his attitude towards his presidency. But when the time came, he became what he is. He became absolutely a different personality because he was this way all this time. And this touches upon so many people who were, for instance, I know radio hosts, and I have this episode in my book, but decided to join home guard units that had little to no weapons, had to, you know, get their own clothes and garments for fighting, for, you know, participating in the city defense. But nonetheless, they were doing this. It's about this insane enthusiasm and the enthusiasm of the doomed, like, you know, a top hip-hop star in Ukraine, in the middle of Kiev, in downtown Kiev, singing songs with a rifle in his hands because he joined patrol units, police patrol units, and he's a top-tier hip-hop star, singing loud, and all these videos, they make it to the internet, and more people see this. So it's the sense of unity, inspiration, you know. But to me, when it comes to this particular aspect, to me the top moment came, I think it was from February 25th, the day two, when so many regular people in Kiev's district Oblon, is the northern part of Kiev, there was a video that went viral on the internet, and it was showing regular people getting their rifles from police. I know the boxes full of rifles arrived on trucks, and very, very regular people without any, you know, enlistment and documents and anything. And police used to deliver all those weapons to the regular people because people were getting ready to actually defend their own streets and you know, meet up Russians and fight Russians. And you could see from this, these moments, you can see that for most of those people, you know, that was the first moment in their life that they had a weapon in their hands. Nonetheless, so many regular people were getting weapons to fight and very probably die in the streets of their own city. And they, moreover, did not move their weapons, these weapons against, let's say, you know, what Russia claims is to be Nazi government of Ukraine or something like that, and not absolutely. They... very regular people just like you and me, who you see in the streets every single day, were doing this. They were ready to fight and die in their own streets. To me, that was the top moment when I realized that we're going to win this war. Russians are not going to make it. But I expected hard urban battle, but that was the moment, the peak moment. And this is something I always refer to this, but this is exactly what Winston Churchill once upon a time called the finest hour. That was the finest hour. But it happened in Ukraine.
You describe in very moving detail the horror and heroism of the Battle of Kiev. But there's another side of this, of course, and this is the Russians arrive and they turn your suburbs and your cities into a hellscape resembling Stalingrad, and these historic images that we see from almost 100 years ago in the 1940s. What, in your view, is it about Russia that it repeats these patterns of history, that it seems to recreate the most hellish times of its own history and European history, and seems to repeat them almost in a sort of endless loop? What was the impression you had when, you know, you started to be immersed in this Russian hellscape?
I grew up in Eastern Ukraine, in Donbas, and my hometown is under Russian occupation right now. And I grew up, as many people in my homeland, we grew up having a mindset that is really close to what's happening in Russia. So we have been mentally pretty close to what's happening to Russia, and then the Russian narratives and all those things for decades. So I know a bit about what's in the Russian brains and thoughts, and public narrative and authorities and regime and so many other things. To me, what we saw in the suburbs of Kyiv, this terrible battle that was fierce from both sides, that was brutal from on both sides, full of emotions, full of dedication from both sides, acts of cruelty too. To me, that was the result of everything that we saw. We've been witnessing this, but we in many ways ignored this. These decades of aggressive propaganda, these decades of absurd things happening on Russian TV that we often fail to take seriously. This cultivation of revanchism, territorial grabs, this instigation of bitterness, of these, never-ending seeking for revenge for the past glory of the Soviet Union that ended like 3 years ago. Well, this paradise lost in the Soviet Union, a completely lying concept and the perception, but still, human minds are plastic, are very plastic. You can shape them, can give them any shape if you have enough resources and if you are dedicated enough, especially when you have evil intentions behind your soul. That was the result of this promotion of Russian superiority over the neighboring nations, this promotion of Russians feeling superior to Ukrainians, particularly Ukrainians feeling hostile towards Ukrainians. Ukrainians in many ways being something in between of being like a lost younger brothers and subhumans who betrayed Russia. So I can talk about this for hours and hours, but it's been a result of all this cultivation of totalitarianism, of this cult of war, and and this this thirst for revenge about this. So when elite Russian paratroopers, their units entered places like Bucha, so they treated local people accordingly because they are superior. They came here to liberate you from yourself because you are Nazis and we are superior. We are heirs to the glory of the Soviet Union and the victory, the blissful victory of the Soviet Union in World War II. We are absolutely morally pure in this, and you are absolutely morally filthy. So you need to be purged and liberated. So that's the, it's we like I said, we really failed to notice this. We in many ways we absurdize all those things that we happen in. We were just thinking about Russians getting bonkers on their TV. But unfortunately, we greatly underestimated the effects of that when that happens for decades and when it occupies so many minds, especially when it comes to cultivating this aggression. So in many ways, this happened in Bucha, in Irpin. Moreover, this effect was amplified by the Ukrainian resistance and the this inevitable coming of fear, sense of insecurity that comes to occupational troops as they face hostile resistance from the opposing army, but also from guerrillas. And they sense the fear, they sense the danger from every corner, so they are not sure if that guy or girl is not involved in guerrilla fighting or subversive activities. So it cultivates even more and more, so it becomes a violent process. So the result is what we saw, is what we saw in many places of Kyiv Oblast. There's been statistics, fresh statistics revealed by the police, published by the Ukrainian police. So we ended up unearthing and revealing close to 1,000 bodies in Kyiv Oblast, and nearly 500 of them were revealed here in Bucha, because Bucha was one of the centers of logistics, one of the hardest places for battle, and naturally, it involved a lot of incidents like Russian soldiers, particularly paratrooper units, just gathering local males of fit local males who were suspected of being territorial defense fighters, and brought to the corner and shot dead, executed in the place. This is what happens when you spend decades preparing an entire nation, and particularly your military, for territorial grabs, for aggressive war. As simple as that.
And how important is it that you've described yourself as a Donbass boy? I assume that in school and throughout your life, Russian played an important role, as many people from Eastern Ukraine it did. How important is it that you become a war reporter, that you disprove the Russian propagandistic lie that somehow they're coming to save Russian speakers, save Russian culture, etc.? And push back these extremists from the west of Ukraine. How important is it that you specifically, with your background, are one of these strong voices countering the Russian narrative?
I really hope that my work for all these years, it had some effect on disproving propaganda and bringing more truthful image of Ukraine, in particularly in the West, especially given the fact that I grew up in those places. I spent 24 years of my life in there. I became a personality in those places, and then only then I moved to Kyiv to work as this in many ways, it happened that I had a lot of so-called preferences among the Ukrainian military when they got it that I am a local guy in Donbas, so I came there because they really appreciate those who are not poisoned by Russian propaganda, who actually understand what it is about. It's something that we don't like to talk these days about in Ukraine, but it was never about language. It's a terrible simplification. It's absurd simplification that, for instance, people like Elon Musk, they say that, so what, Eastern Southern Ukraine speaks Russian, so they definitely want to be part of Russia. No, it's not this way. This doesn't work that way. It's not about language. You can speak any language you like, but you do not want to be part of that regime. You do not want to be the life that Russians, ordinary Russians, have. You do not want to grow up in that atmosphere of unfreedom that is growing worse. Russia is now pretty as close to being a totalitarian state as it possible. It's about so many things that contradict your own education, your own plans for the future, your own image of the country you want to live in. And on the other hand, we have Ukraine, and we are absolutely integrated into Ukrainian cultural life, Ukrainian, public life. We're absolutely involved in things that changed today's Ukraine, like Euromaidan Revolution. I was the guy who launched the first rally, Euromaidan rally in Mariupol. Was just a handful of my friends and several university lecturers. That was me. That was I. Because we believed in those values, we absolutely understand the same future for this country as we want. So it's not about language. It's not about language you prefer to talk to use as you talk to your friends and relatives. It's about values. We want to be, and people in, let's say, from Kyiv, of our generation who grew up on these values, we now have like a common image of what we want to have in this country. So you could be as Russian speaking as you want, but it's about your values. So that's why you very often see Russian-speaking soldiers fighting, fiercely fighting, because they know what it is about, and they want to be part of Ukraine because we feel this as our home. We don't want any other country. I hope that really works in this. But what's really problematic about such things is that, you know, it's very easy to say this oversimplified statements like all Russian speaking Ukrainians want to be part of Russia because they speak Russian. So what? And it's really hard to talk about and persuade people in a bit more complicated truth and realities that we are discussing right now. It's not that simple. So in other words, same propaganda, simplistic and dumb propaganda and absurd propaganda is really easy, and it makes a shorter way to people's brain, to human brains. Sometimes it's harder to counter it with actual facts, because life is a bit more complicated than that. But it's something that is our duty, I believe, especially in wartime. It's something that we need to do. And I guess we're not 100% successful in this, but we are doing this.
Talking of that complex, nuanced truth, there are independent media such as the Kyiv Independent, there's Kyiv Post, and there's other publications writing in both English and Ukrainian, doing a good job, I think, of reporting the detail. Whether that is favorable to the Ukrainian side or not, speaking the truth seems to be a priority. How much of a challenge, however, has it been to sustain what you've described as very necessary journalism and objectivity during wartime?
Oh, you know, being a English language media outlet in Ukraine has never been easy. Not gonna lie this to you. For many years, Kyiv Post was basically the only one, or a dominant one, next to several dwarfs that were not serious in many regards. The coming of Euromaidan changed things a bit, because in general the entire nation got closer to Western values, you know, English language, to looking more into foreign countries, into West, you know, moving West. And of course this amplified with the gathering storm of war, of full-scale war. And right now, basically, I would say that, yeah, we have a couple of specialized English language media outlets, Ukrainian media outlets, speaking English, and most of the biggest media outlets here in Ukraine, they also have like an English language chapters that they try to work with. But other than that, right now Ukraine is still surprisingly in the focus of attention of all global media. So global media is still in here, very much in here. They do a spectacular job in many regards that we really appreciate. What's a problem is that, of course, it's been always a money issue, because in Ukraine, media advertisement market is non-existent. And it's a problem not only about foreign language publications, but also about the entire Ukrainian media market. It's really hard to be independent. It's really hard to be sustainable in terms of your funding in Ukraine. It's a big pain, in a big headache for you. I think we have maybe a couple of major media outlets that feel independent, and they can be sure about their profitability and their sustainability without, you know, going and asking for money from money bags, oligarchs that never do this for free, of course. So in many ways, why we called our media outlet the Kyiv Independent, which we established in November 2021, shortly before the coming of war. And we call this independent because we were absolutely fed up with being dependent on a guy who gives money and who tells us what to do. Which is the reason why we were all sacked from the Kyiv Post. It's some sunny day, several days before the Kyiv Independent was established. The Kyiv Independent was and is an independent media publication because of just one reason, because of insane support from the audience. Not many media outlets in Ukraine. I would say that Kyiv Independent was among the few ones who really can sustain from actual readers, from donations, from subscriptions, and from public support, you know, from in Ukraine. That's the only way to do that. And when it comes to things like objectivity and the you know, sustainability of your media outlet in Ukraine, people, your only chance is to gather a lot of people willing to donate and to keep you afloat. And you can't do that. You can get that without being honest, sincere, reliable, truthful, and without people, so many people feeling this and knowing that they can trust you. So that's the model that worked with the Kyiv Independent. And this is the idea and model that works with me personally, because when I quit Kyiv Independent, I started doing journalism on my own on Twitter, and sometimes suggesting that, you know, my audience just gives donations. If you like this, if you want to support this, it's absolutely beyond any, you know, paywalls or subscriptions or something like that, because I do this majorly for my country, for my duty. But if you're willing to support this, here you go. You can do this. And it really worked for me too. So I keep saying this all this time of war, that honesty, sincerity, and trust really works. It's the only way for you to gain support and to be independent. That's how it works. Nothing else works in Ukraine.
I would say that that's a fairly perhaps universal idea as well. You know, if you're beholden to owners of a particular media, there's always going to be a slant in some ways, whether it's implied or explicit. Now, censorship in Britain during World War II was actually incredibly harsh and quite intense. Have you found that you have to dance around wartime censorship, or dare I say, even involvement of you know, intelligence services, or have you had a fairly free reign as far as editorial topics covered, looking into subjects like corruption, for instance? Because, you know, what a key part of Maidan and the subsequent judicial and social reforms, as well as a feature of Ukrainian civic society, is the strong investigation and pushback against corruption. So how have you found the freedom to cover these kind of topics?
Hand on heart, we do not have the sort of wartime censorship that you think about as you think about World War II time in Britain, for instance. In many ways, it happened because these are very different times that we are having right now. It's the very different model of society, very different model of media aspects and how it works, especially when it comes to the time of social media and a Facebook page in everyone's pocket. You know, World War II style censorship just doesn't work. It's just not possible. When it comes to what we actually have, is that Ukraine remains, despite wartime, it remains what it is, what it has always been, a super boiling country with super violent public discussion, extremely emotional, extremely vibrant. Like, it's a boiling pot of Facebook posts in where everyone has an opinion. It's very brutal in terms of domestic, strife and fighting and discussing everything. and hating on politicians that you don't like and defending the politicians. It's like it's a full-scale boiling pot of political life, super emotional, just like in any sustained democracy, especially when it comes to, you know, Ukraine, which is a country with a huge thorn in the ass, as we call it, so it can be calmed. So because of this nature, it's really hard to conceal something. It's really hard for authorities to put pressure upon journalists, because like I said, it's always an explosion of emotions on Facebook. Sometimes we refer to our country as what's the word for this? It's like a Facebookocracy, something like that. So it's a country ruled by opinion leaders and, you know, thousands of likes on Facebook. So but the public discussion in Ukraine is extremely volatile. What we have in Ukraine is that, for instance, when it comes to corruption, we really have an outbreak of corruption, anti-corruption investigations in when it comes to the military, when it comes to security forces too. So there has been an upsurge of this. Ukrainian journalists has always been strong in terms of, you know, anti-corruption investigations. We have several very strong media outlets do this, but right now it's even more important, even more, and it gets as much emotions and as much attention from general audiences than before because it's wartime. As an illustration of what we have in Ukraine, you know, the other days you might remember, we actually dethroned a defense minister for following a corruption scandal because of procurement, food procurement in the military. Following insane scandals, the defense minister was dethroned.
Mr. Reznikov, Alex Reznikov,
yeah. Defense minister Reznikov, the former defense minister, that was in many ways tip of the iceberg behind the whole thing. But and Minister Reznikov has had his positive sides and he has done a lot, but nonetheless, though, that was the effect of insane scandals that followed journalistic investigations, which is something, and in, you know, corruption in defense ministry, in military procurement, is absolutely something that we cannot tolerate, especially in wartime, especially in time of war against Russia. Another thing is that sometimes when you work as a journalist, it's not simply about things like military officials telling us what to write or what not to write. It's about lots of bureaucracy. It's about lots of and not intended omission of authorities, and not because they really want to conceal you something from you, but sometimes, you know, most of the military officials and bureaucrats are not competent and not interested in their work. So it's more about this thing. Another thing is that we in Ukraine recently had a massive scandal with SBU security force. It's the internal security security agency, and it was revealed that certain department of the SBU, which was responsible for the protection of nationhood or something like that, you know, something like that, it actually spied on journalists on investigation project Vihusinfo, and they revealed a shocking revelation that their camera specialists during their Christmas time vacation smoked pot somewhere following their meeting. And that was just, you know, a lot of outbreak, a lot of anger, but not because of their cameraman, camera girls, I guess, smoking pot, but about, you know, the security agencies spying on journalists, on camera people of journalists who do investigations. That was massive scandal, lots of anger in Ukraine. And in the end of this, you know, these guys, these investigators, they investigated the whole thing. They absolutely unveiled the way and the absolutely hilarious story of how the SBU people were spying on them and what they did on Christmas time, during in some sort of a resort in the woods, not far away from this place, by the way, in Bucha. That was a hilarious story, but nonetheless, that was a massive scandal about this. So, in general, Ukraine for the last decade, or in general, it's the entire decade, the entire period and decades of Ukrainian independence was always about this struggle within. Ukraine is always in the struggle between from one side, journalists, activists, good-hearted officials, and those who advocate reforms and promote westernization, promote reforms, combat corruption. And from other side, we have corrupt officials, we have officials who abuse their power. We have also so many things that make us similar to Russia and who drag us back to being similar to Russia and who drag us back to those times. So it's always an insane battle. There's been, it has always been this way, and it's still now in wartime. So it's not about censorship that you think about. It's about Ukraine still fighting, not war against, not only the war against, foreign invaders, but also, really fighting hard to make itself a better place.
That process of de-Russification to an extent, which is a decades-long process, that's fascinating. But you mentioned Western reporting, and you put it in a very positive light. If I could perhaps sort of throw at you some concerns there, though, because there is some fantastic reporting, and there's some fantastic individual reporters and analysts, absolutely, no question. But if we take the mainstream Western media, it seems to me that there are a number of problems. One is the depth and frequency of coverage, the fact that actually very important things are happening, but they get only cursory mentions in the Western press, including many of Ukraine's successes over the last couple of months around the Black Sea and, of course, in targeting Russian oil facilities. There also seems to be problematic reporting, which comes from a number of different failings, but a classic example of that is around the Kakhovka Dam. Absolutely dreadful reporting, almost across the board in the West, I would say, failing essentially to look at any of the information or circumstantial evidence that Russia had intentionally, caused that ecological disaster, but just generally extremely poor reporting. And then when evidence does come to light, there's no kind of prominent follow-up to try to reset the record. If you're going to put a hypercritical cap on, what would you say is the gaps and failings of Western reporting during this war?
In general, just I'm expressing nothing but my opinion. In general, I think the Russian full-scale war is, in many ways, was the illustration of why we still need journalism, why journalism matters, and why it actually works not to entertain, people with news or something like that, but it actually works to hopefully resolve the evils of this world. Hand on heart, I believe what we saw, particularly during the Battle of Kyiv, with so many Western journalists working in here, basically the top-tier media all being in there next to us on battlefields and in the city. I think the Western reporting did the best job it was possible. That was possible. In general, journalism, particularly Western journalism, just in many ways proved itself. It was one of the best cases for Western journalism in its history. When it comes to things like Western reports, places like Bucha, in many ways, what we know about Bucha, what the all the amount of everything that tells us what happened here, undeniable evidence of what was happening, from satellite pictures to drone footage that's verified under astronomical features that absolutely prove the genuinity of these videos, showing Russian authorities and showing the result of Russian presence in here. That was in many ways down to the videos of actually Russian troops killing people in there from security cameras. That was the work from, for instance, the New York Times. One of the best pieces of journalism ever seen by anyone. And on one of the most important topics that could be in our time. But at the same time, you know, New York Times has gained a bit of notoriety. Let's go a soft way with weird takes and weird opinions about Ukraine and about Ukrainian matters and being wrong sometimes in this. But I would say that it's these things in this, like, it's extremely naive and hypocritical reporting on the Ukrainian, or oversimplification, or something that we feel is extremely irrelevant narratives about Ukraine. I think it could be described more about, more like, you know, the benefits and pains of democracy, because, you know, there are lots of voices, there are lots of people are different. Let's start this way. Are we all humans? People are different, you know, lots of voices, lots of reasons, lots of points of view on this, very different patterns of experience, when, especially when it comes to, you know, knowing what Ukrainian is and understanding the Ukrainian context and seeing what's relevant and what's not. The pain, pain of that is that, yes, people are different, and you can't say no to all those people in their right to publish, to, you know, publish this or that. So you can't simply, you know, dictate what's to be reported and what is not. But the good side of this is that at the same time, this freedom of expression, this competition of ideas, I would say, gives more resources, gives more intention to stronger voices, to more professional journalists. And, you know, you can't get a good journalism in a totalitarian state that dictates, you know, what to think about and the way people need to think about. So the only way to have a strong journalism is to put it in the environment of freedom. And yes, sometimes there'll be things that are stupid. Sometimes there'll be things that you feel irrelevant and weak. But that's the negative side. But the good side of this, which we described in the absolute terrific Western investigations of Bucha, that absolutely would leave no doubts about Russian role and Russian killings and what's happening, and about death of all those people that we found in mass graves, and we, as we entered Bucha. That's the good side of this, and it really prevails over the bad side of this model. So we are where we are now.
And your book helps, I think, to address this as well. It adds an extra layer of impression, a real emotional and visceral connections to the events, which sometimes reporting doesn't quite get across, or people aren't in the right frame of mind. So I think your book's incredibly important to sort of add on to that reporting. But it does lead me to ask, and this is the sort of last area of questioning, really, the other challenge of Western media and Western audiences, and that is attention span. And we're now in the third year of war. It's likely to carry on through this year, potentially next year, unless there is, you know, some extraordinary event or collapse in Russia, which we can't totally dismiss, but also difficult to engineer something like that. Attention span is a crucial problem. And now Russia is really scaling up the so-called gray zone warfare, with the Baltic jammer affecting tens of thousands of flights. You've got acts of sabotage really not being reported extensively across Europe. And there are many other instances that are starting to make it into, say, Twitter and those who are following the conflict, but not the mainstream media. If the war itself is difficult enough for people to keep their attention span, isn't the complexity and nuances of Russia's global gray zone warfare, isn't that even bigger challenge for news media to get people's focus and attention?
It's a challenge. It's definitely one of the hardest things. But at the same time, I'm not sure how it works, but I'm really surprised that we still have a lot of attention more than 2 years after the attack. I mean, what happened 2 years ago in February 2022 was super super unbelievable and super just groundbreaking, because that was a very rare historical event, so wide, so large, and so dramatic. But, you know, it's been more than 2 years, and we still have a lot of attention, I would say. Yes, it dropped somewhat, but at the same time, you know, the very nature of this war and the very story and the timeline of this war, it's so dramatic. It's so full of absolutely mind-blowing things that keep happening and keep making headlines. You know, we will spend all day just recollecting all those things that absolutely blow our minds, and things that we could not even closely imagine 2 years ago, like Black Sea fleet of Russia being sunk by Ukrainian, like drones attacking the Kremlin, like so many, like Russia losing 3,000 tanks, like Russia losing cities occupied in Ukraine. I can count more again and again and again and again and again.
British missiles taking out the Black Sea Fleet headquarters. I mean, that was a moment of extraordinary drama, like, as well.
Russian generals killed. And it's about large, but also a lot of little things that happened in this war. I know it's sometimes it feels really like a sort of, you know, divine intervention or something like that, poetically speaking. The very nature of this war, the very structure of and the logic of this black and white war that was established by Russians themselves in many ways, because it's a very rare historical occasion that we have such a black and white kind of war in which two sides are so distinctively separated by the morality. It's a very rare thing. And this very nature of this war, it dictates all those spectacular things that are happening in there, because it's such a David versus Goliath battle that it absolutely cannot help being absolutely mind-blowing and inspiring to many people and making headlines. It's definitely a dramatic war, a melodramatic war. Sometimes, you know, I once upon a time I even had a bit of a conspiracy theory with me, is that, you know, Ukrainian security agencies, they do things like pro-Ukrainian Russian groups entering Russia and, you know, combating Russian forces without any tangible and clearly understandable military goal, but with a lot of attention drawn to this, with lots of pictures for media. Sometimes I had a bit of a conspiracy theory that sometimes they give this a go for the sake of keeping the attention on Ukraine and showing something spectacular to people, so that people are still involved in this, and media outlets are still involved in this. I know, of course, it's nothing but my joke and explanation, but still, it's just the nature of this war that keeps us going in there. And it's been more than 2 years, we're still there. But sometimes
I had that same thought, and I don't think it's conspiratorial. I mean, I think almost certainly certain things are timed to try and punctuate or grab global attention in key moments, you know, when let's say Zelensky's in Washington or something. I mean, I think that's quite a strategic way of doing things, actually.
I think, as it often happens in life, it's both. It's both that Ukrainian authorities, they understand the the importance of media attention and the importance of having a public opinion in Western countries on our side too, and also the very objective nature of this war, with Russia failing so spectacularly and Ukraine performing so so successfully, especially given the disbalance of resources and powers in this war. So this is one of the things that was precipitated by the spirit of doing what is right, like do what you should and be what may. That is in many ways brought us where we are right now, and this is in many ways what the book is about, because sometimes we, even here in Ukraine, especially here in Ukraine, to be honest, we sometimes fall short of this hope that and the spirit that was all around in the Battle of Kyiv. So in many ways, I wrote this book, and I'm really glad that it comes out in this time, because sometimes even myself and my people around me, we could use some hope from those days. Yeah.
That's an important message to end on. I strongly recommend people check out the book. I think it does show the inspiration, really, behind Ukrainian resilience, victory, and why Ukraine needs to win in this war. I hope this is just the first chapter that you're writing, and that subsequent volumes will come out to tell the rest of the story of the war, because I think it's an incredibly powerful voice you have, and you're a witness, as you say, to an extraordinary history. Ilya, thank you so much, though, for sharing this and appearing on the channel.
Thank you. That was a very interesting conversation. Thank you.